Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. In one of the first acts of his second presidential term, Donald Trump issued pardons to more than 1,500 defendants in cases related to the January 6, 2021 U.S. Capitol insurrection. Many of these defendants included members of far-right groups like the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers. Donald Trump's links to the right, including to the far-right and the alt-right, date back at least to his 2016 presidential campaign and continued through his first term and then into his 2024 election campaign, where Trump faced accusations of being an authoritarian populist. To discuss Donald Trump and the far-right, in February 2025, I spoke to Dr. Rachel Bloom, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science, and the Carl Albert Congressional Research and Studies Center at the University of Oklahoma. Dr. Bloom's research focuses on party factions and their impact on contemporary U.S. politics. Her most recent book is How the Tea Party Captured the GOP, published in 2020. I began by asking Dr. Bloom to outline their research and current work.
My name is Dr. Rachel Bloom. I am an assistant, hopefully soon to be an associate professor at the University of Oklahoma, which is in Norman, Oklahoma. It's kind of our state's flagship research university. There, I have a joint appointment in the Department of Political Science and in the Carl Albert Congressional Research and Studies Center. I teach classes in both, and my research is primarily in political parties. I've primarily focused on the American case, looking at different aspects of it, including state-level parties, activists, congressional dynamics, and my kind of emerging future research projects are more interested in looking at the U.S. as a comparative case compared to other North American and Western European countries.
In 2023, you wrote for the LSE Phelan U.S. Center's USAP blog on how the Tea Party movement helped to shift the Republican Party to the right. Is the Tea Party still with us, or has it changed into something else?
The Tea Party in name is not still with us, but it would be hard to understand the Trump faction of the Republican Party, or MAGA, or the House Freedom Caucus, which is very much still with us and was very much a creature of the Tea Party, without the Tea Party. I see the Tea Party as kind of the antecedent to all of that. They did the difficult work of making inroads with all the local state party organizations, with pushing out legislators who didn't agree with them, kind of in preparation for Donald Trump. But nowadays, the things that used to be considered Tea Party are so core to the Republican Party that they don't really need to be a fringe or factional movement anymore.
How does this relate to how the far right, sort of the MAGA movement, has been able to take over the Republican Party?
Yeah, I think there are a couple ways that they're related. The first is in shifting the terms on which political battles are fought. So the Tea Party was really instrumental in a sea change in American politics towards procedural radicalism. Now we talk a lot about, you know, the norms are gone, civility is gone, but Trump didn't start that. He just, again, benefited from it. The Tea Party was really the first group that was willing to even tank their own party's electoral prospects in order to get someone who agreed with them slightly more into office or to contest them, and kind of how they dealt with that, how they kept that from being a totally failing electoral strategy, was by ramping up attacks on the opposite party as well. So that creates an environment where going to Congress and not doing anything except for trying to dismantle the federal government, that is a Tea Party thing and something they made seem normal, kind of flouting the regular rules, using kind of extra legal measures to do things, is very much a Tea Party style strategy, delegitimizing political opponents, claiming Barack Obama was a Muslim from Africa, for example, very much part of the Tea Party strategy. The Make America First rhetoric was part of the Tea Party long before Donald Trump adopted it. We could think that the Tea Party has laid the groundwork in terms of removing potential obstacles to Trump or kind of the far right faction of the Republican Party, both within the party organization and within legislatures, changing the terms of the debate, both for Republicans when they talk to one another and how they talk to the rest of the country or the other party, which is now just solidly understood as the enemy. I think those are probably two of its biggest impacts. I think there are some also just some links to Donald Trump, but these things are hard to kind of tease apart. You know, what came first, what causes what? They're all part of the same soup.
Political divides have been part of American politics since the nation's founding, really. Have these divides deepened over the last decade or so?
Absolutely. So we can look at this in a lot of ways, but one of the most common ones is to use the Poole and Rosenthal DW nominate scores, which are ideology scores for members of Congress. If we look at those, we see that the Republican and Democratic parties in Congress over the last, I would say, since the mid-90s to early 2000s, so 20, 25 years, have started to go further and further away from each other to an extent we have not seen since the years leading up to the Civil War or immediately after the Civil War. So this is definitely not normal in American politics. What has been more normal in American politics is for one party to kind of dominate the presidency and Congress for extended periods of time, if not only dominating Congress. In every party era, we have tended to have this. So the era we're in now, kind of since 1994, really, where control of the legislature continues to switch and control of the presidency continues to switch, is really unusual for us. And it's this area of kind of extended competition. Francis Lee calls them insecure majorities. And it incentivizes a lot of short-term promises and anti-outsider, anti-the-other rhetoric, and a lot more kind of posturing than actually legislating.
These divisions that you're talking about, are they damaging for the U.S., or are they just kind of part of the way the system's been designed? Is this kind of a built-in inevitability, or is this a problem that is causing problems, I guess?
I think it's a problem that's causing problems. It's definitely not built into the design. So to me, the core design in the U.S. is this three-part separation of powers, with kind of a fourth check being the state, federal system powers, maybe a free media being an additional check. But those three branches of government working as checks, that was designed in a world without parties, and especially without partisan polarization. As soon as you introduce partisan polarization, instead of Congress against the president, against the courts, you have Republicans in Congress against Democrats in Congress. And if the president is Republican and the court's majority Republican, you actually just have one party controlling all three branches. There is no more check, right? Mike Johnson is not jealous of the way Donald Trump is taking some of the House's power. So definitely not how it was designed. There are various writings and speeches from James Madison, George Washington on the mischiefs of party and dangers of party and faction. So they were certainly aware that something like this could happen. And they were very worried about the tyranny of the majority, but also of small minority groups using procedural levers to get power, kind of that outpaces their size. The impact on Americans, I think, is hard to overstate. There's been, I think, a profound decline in civility and tolerance. Now, this is not to say that as a country, we are renowned for our civility and tolerance, but you know, these things can always get worse. So since, I would say the second Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s and the anti-segregation movements in the 50s to 1970s, we've had a less contentious period in terms of in-groups and out-groups. And all of that is over now. It is very hard to live in America and not know that you are an outgroup to someone else. And I think that's been especially a problem on the American right. Citizens on the American right are much more likely to see partisanship or politics as their identity. And people on the American right are also much more likely to be demographically more homogenous. White people of Eastern Europe or Western European descent, for the most part, not as educated per se, maybe Christian, maybe believing in more traditional gender roles. Republicans just have a lot in common with one another. Democrats don't. Democrats encompass literally everyone else. So it's pretty easy if you're a Republican to tell who the outgroup is. It's anyone who's not quite like you. And that's created, obviously, huge societal divisions and huge divisions down to the interpersonal level at the state and local level. It's concerning. I could go on.
Thank you. I'd just like to pick up on a point you're talking about, everyone being aware of being part of an out-group, and I guess that means that they also know they're part of a certain in-group as well. So the Republicans are in power now. How does that impact the way they view themselves as an in or an out-group, given that they effectively control all three branches of government, especially given that they would have been the out-group the previous 4 years?
That's a fascinating thing about the Republicans. Even when they're in power, they never drop the victimhood narrative, and they never stop seeing people who aren't like them as threats. I'm not quite sure where it comes from, but I think some of it has to do with the importance of evangelical American Christianity in that party. Evangelical Americans for a very long time have been taught to believe that they are being persecuted. It starts probably in the 1980s when schools no longer can force students to say Christian prayers and that kind of thing. So when the dominance of Protestant Christianity starts to recede, when people can't be forced to observe Protestant Christian practices anymore, this to the Protestant evangelical community translates as persecution, right? That they believe that the country should be Christian. There should not be a separation between the church and state. So anything short of that is persecution. And I think a lot of that kind of Manichaean, black and white, good versus evil thinking has permeated the Republican Party. And then, of course, Donald Trump is very, very good at sounding like a victim in a way that doesn't offend people who say they don't like victims. It's utterly fascinating, but they are not acting like a party that feels confident that they have power. They are acting a little bit recklessly, but I mean, I don't know how far to speculate here, but in some ways they're acting like a party that will never lose power again. And somehow the victim ethos is part of that. They need to take these extra legal means because the entire apparatus of the culture and society and of the civil servants are all liberals and they're against them. That's kind of the narrative. And it's this unfairness that has forced the Trump Republicans to have to take these extra legal means. It's all part of that narrative.
Just picking up on the ideas of the Republicans, many of them feeling like they're the victim. What then is the win condition for Republicans? How will they, or will they ever be satisfied with control of government, with getting their policies through, or will it be continual victimhood sort of sense throughout the time that they govern?
It doesn't seem right now that any level of victory is enough. If we continue sliding into competitive authoritarianism, we could very well have a situation where the Republicans really aren't contested for power or can't really be removed from office. And then that might change things a little bit. Then I think that they would turn their eyes inwards again, though, because a lot of the Republican Party's problems have nothing to do with the Democratic Party and everything to do with the internal disagreement within the Republican Party. So Republicans might agree symbolically on being conservative, whatever that means to them, but they don't agree a lot on policy. I think a good example of this is when they got their way with the overturning of abortion rights in Roe versus Wade. As soon as that battle, which had been for decades just the cause for Republicans and conservatives, as soon as that battle was won, they were in disarray because it turned out there are actually a lot of disagreements within the party about what to do next. They're still pretty divided on this. This is why it's very hard for them to put forward any kind of national solution. And the more complicated and technical it gets, the more divided it turns out that they are. I think that even if they are able to stay in power for quite a while, there will still be divisions. They'll just be intra-party divisions. And because of that, they might not feel that they are actually winning, even when they are.
We're having this conversation in early February 2025. We're a few weeks into the second term of President Donald Trump. Is Donald Trump a far-right politician, or is he simply using the far-right to achieve his political goals?
He's certainly a far-right politician. I don't think these things are really that different. He's definitely a populist outsider. And populist outsiders tend to follow similar patterns. And they tend to gravitate towards the far right or receive the most support from the far right just over time, but especially in our current political moment. There are left populists, right? But the far right populists are ones who are willing to claim it is your society, it is the established government, it is the constitutional order that's the enemy of the people. Those politicians are all over Europe right now, in South America, elsewhere in the world, and also in the United States, because of his kind of game show celebrity that he had beforehand. One of the most charismatic and best representations of a far-right populist leader. The things that would make him far-right are his willingness to undermine the constitutional order if it means he can get ahead, his willingness to vilify or delegitimize his political opponents, to weaponize or destroy the government. There are always these kind of patterns, and the blame is typically placed on outsiders, understood often as non-native born people. But in the US, it's often, you know, hard to tell who is born here and who isn't. So functionally, it translates into being against or blaming anyone who is brown or black.
So one of President Trump's first actions when he came into office was to pardon more than 1,500 January 6th defendants. What message was Trump sending through making these pardons?
He was definitely sending a message that the law only applies selectively. And this isn't a new message for him. Even in his first campaign in 2015, 2016, he would encourage members in his audience to beat up protesters and tell them that he would pay their legal bills. So this is not at all new for him. And arguably, his supporters knew that he would try to pardon them. And that was just part of the whole game. But the message it sends to Americans is that if you break the law and commit acts of violence, but they are out of loyalty to Donald Trump, it's okay. If you are not loyal to Donald Trump, you better be careful. And so it starts to legitimize extra legal means and citizen violence, just quite bluntly.
Should Americans be worried about the growing influence of the far right, including militia groups, on Donald Trump and the Republican Party more generally?
I think so. I mean, they've been there for a while. They were a huge part of the Tea Party's network. But now they've gone from being at the fringe of the party to being kind of people that the insiders were a little uncomfortable associating with to being the inside of the party. There are many ways to see this. So, for example, Pete Hegseth's Department of Defense was doing some recruiting recently. They typically, this time of year, would go to a Black Engineers event to recruit people who are very talented in STEM fields. They canceled that, ended that partnership, and instead went and recruited at an NRA event, which is a gun event. And these kinds of events tend to bring in gun hobbyists, militia-type people. So this is now where we're actually recruiting for civil servants. So not only is this legitimate at this point, but it's even prized. And I think that's something Americans should be incredibly worried about. We've not seen a period, again, outside of the second Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s, when the state sponsored this much violence towards other citizens or towards duly elected officials.
How do you think other countries should treat the rise of the far right in the U.S.? Is this something they should be worried about?
Absolutely. I think at this point, it's pretty far gone. I just think what's happening in the U.S. should be kind of worrying in general. So the U.S. is certainly not going to step back into any kind of role as a global power player or a country that deserves respect anytime soon. Like these kinds of the alliances we've left, the agreements we've left, the organizations we've left, if we get another president in there and they do what Joe Biden did and re-enter everything, no one's going to believe that we will stay in those agreements. So the U.S. is now a politically unstable country that is an unreliable partner and could very easily turn on its friends and make them enemies. I think that is just from a kind of global security perspective, a problem for every country right now. The Pax Americana, it is definitely over. I think that we can also see the U.S. as one of the starkest and most alarming examples of Democratic backsliding in recent years. I mean, there are others, right? Hungary, Poland, Israel, maybe Uruguay. But the U.S. Has had the oldest and most developed democracy out of all those countries. In some cases, was even part of state building in those countries when they were trying to develop democracies. So when the U.S. can't hold up the democracy anymore, it raises a lot of questions about whether this experiment was a good idea at all, whether all the countries that followed with democratic revolutions really should have. And I think it could give legitimacy in other countries to the far right in different ways. We'll see, you know, they're controlling the U.S. Why can't they have power here? What if we want to also have nationalist policies? It could spur more Brexit-style sentiments in other parts of Europe, especially countries that have kind of surges of nationalism. It will produce copycat leaders, as these things always do. And we can very well see a series of strongman, and I use that like technically like authoritarian-style leader, personal alliances across the world that would undermine all kinds of things that we have thought were just unquestionable. There's definitely a world where it's like Trump and Putin against the free countries of Western Europe. This seems to me not very far off. And we're certainly not a country that could be relied upon in global conflict.
Just thinking about Trump's motions towards places like Greenland, is there any playbook by which countries that are concerned about this sort of thing can tackle this sort of authoritarianism that's kind of, if not in their backyard, might be moving into it?
Oh, that's tough. I mean, my first impulse with this kind of thing is always to see if there is a time in history that rhymes. And the Manifest Destiny era of American history is very similar. And really, I would say kind of our colonial period. There was a period in the 19th century where American presidents definitely believed that it was not only our right to control as much as we could in this hemisphere, but our duty to have hemispheric protection. Like, this was somehow something Americans just deserved. And that justified taking all kinds of territory. And as much as we have occupied other countries outside of World War II, this was when it happened, right? This is when we try to get really involved in the Spanish-American War and this kind of thing. It's not clear to me that there's anything that other countries did to stay out of it or to remain impervious to it. I really don't know if, you know, if I were advising Greenland, what I would tell them to do. Because if the United States decided it wanted to, with military force, annex Greenland, Greenland probably couldn't stop them. And it's unclear if the rest of the world would want to fight a war over Greenland, which is obviously very concerning, because we tend to think that acts of territorial aggression are a precursor to other bad things. So we might think of Hitler and Poland, even Russia and Ukraine right now. But we seem to be in a period where territorial aggression is becoming more common. We could look at Israel as another example of this. So I'm really not sure what the rest of the world can do except for be as united as possible against the authoritarian threat, even when it's coming from former friends and allies.
Donald Trump's 2024 election victory over Kamala Harris marked the second time he defeated a candidate who had the potential to become the first woman U.S. president. Do you think these results tell us something about gender and leadership in American politics?
Most likely. It's hard not to see a little bit of a lesson there. We know more about how gender and leadership works in congressional races. So we know that it's harder to get women to run. When they do run, they tend to be more qualified than men. And when they run, they often win. Like, they're not less likely to win in congressional races. But other people think that there's maybe a 1 to 1.5 percentage point penalty for women running, especially in statewide or national offices, which would pretty much explain his entire electoral advantage over Kamala Harris, 1 to 1.5 percentage points. But it definitely signals that we are not a country that has gotten over misogyny or sexism. It's very much alive and well. The number of people who seem okay with ending DEI efforts underscores this as well. So this is definitely a place where a certain group of people, mainly white males, think that they deserve all the power. And if the power goes to anyone else, then that means that there is some sort of racist conspiracy against them. So I think it's definitely, Kamala's defeat should definitely be interpreted as part of that. I would really like to see a female president soon in my lifetime, perhaps. That would be ideal. But it's not really clear to me when that's going to happen.
So we've been talking about how the far right have captured a lot of the Republican Party. Sort of on the other side of the coin, why has the far left not captured part or all of the Democratic Party in the way the far right has captured the GOP?
I think it's a traditional problem with the left in the U.S. We could say it's a problem, a phenomenon maybe, which is that the American left tends to be suspicious of parties. They're very reluctant and have been since at least Americans for Democratic Action started. So we're talking like briefly after World War II. So for a while, Americans on the left have made the choice to not work through the major parties. Some of this is probably part of the ideology, a little bit of left populism that would teach people to be kind of more suspicious of institutions and power brokers. Also, a lot of people on the left are policy purists in a way that the Democratic Party just isn't. The Democratic Party is a very pragmatic, centrist coalition of everyone who's not in the Republican Party. And because the Republican Party has moved so far to the extreme and the Democratic Party is kind of just stuck in this middle position, even if they wanted to, they couldn't fully absorb the left flank. That would, I mean, electorally, that would mean that the Democrats would lose the middle voters that have been their only answer to Republicans' control of electoral institutions in a way that gives a systematic, ingrained advantage to Republicans. So part of it, I guess to sum up, is the left is less interested in controlling the organs of party power than the right is. And the Democratic Party, because of what the Republican Party has done, is in much less of a position to absorb people with extreme views. They've basically been put in the de facto position of being the last advocates for the American constitutional order, which doesn't leave them a lot of time to think about universal health care.
Thinking about the Democrats and considering Trump is limited to a one-term presidency now, how do you predict the Democrats might rebuild over the next 4 years? Might they move further to the right?
That's interesting. I would like to believe that Trump is limited to this term. I think that remains to be seen. I think if we get to 2026 and 2028 and elections work pretty similarly to how they have, and there aren't any greater restraints on voters or ballot access, that would be a sign that maybe we can make it out of this. But if we're assuming that politics will continue as usual, I think things are really hard for the Democrats right now. They are being treated as the only adults in the room. And this has happened for a while. So when Republicans couldn't figure out how to have a Speaker of the House, when they ousted McCarthy in October 23, people started blaming the Democrats for not helping them come up with a leadership solution, as if it was the backbencher's job to help the majority coalition to elect a leader from within their own ranks. Now, people are acting as if the problem is that the Democrats, who are, again, backbenchers in both houses, are the problem, and that what they should really be doing is coming up with a better strategy to oppose the party that has decided to throw its lot in with authoritarianism, which is just kind of an impossible thing to win. Voters seem to at once want the Democratic Party to be doing more. But then when the Democratic Party actually takes the position of this is authoritarianism, we stand for democracy, voters are tired of hearing it. They don't want it. So I think the Democratic Party is kind of in an impossible position right now. I don't think the party as a whole will move further to the right. The party in general has a lot of diverse members who have very different ideologies based on the districts that they represent. And I don't think that that's going to change anytime soon. And I know a lot of Americans want the Democratic Party to have some sort of internal reckoning so that they can come up with a message or just something that will get the white working class or this group or that group back on board and save American democracy. But again, I think that's a really hard thing to do while one of the two parties has abdicated its role as defender of democracy. Like, the Democratic Party can't be both an electoral coalition and the last defender of democracy.
To go back to a point you alluded to about whether or not Trump may continue, for our listeners who might not be aware, it's the 22nd Amendment, isn't it? What should we be looking out for if that constitutional amendment is going to be overlooked, overturned, ignored?
I mean, the most unlikely one would be a constitutional path to changing that amendment, which would be very difficult, right? It would take a majority of states, a supermajority of states. It would take a lot of support from members of Congress. That's not going to happen. It's not going to be constitutionally changed. Instead, it seems that what is going on is a systematic undermining of what the Constitution says can and cannot be done. So when we have undermined it in so many other ways, why should we listen to it in this respect? I mean, I can almost see a J.D. Vance tweet about this. You know, the Constitution has no right to limit the legitimate power of the executive or whatnot, which is almost something he just said. So that is the more likely path, that the Constitution's completely overlooked and there's some sort of just weird loophole that they decide to exploit, or no loophole at all. They just decide that they're going to allow this and the courts say no, and they ask the courts who's going to enforce that decision, because it would typically be the executive branch. It's also possible that Donald Trump, I mean, he's getting old, that he decides not to run for another term, but he leaves the government in such a state that it would be almost impossible for the Democratic Party to regain power. That does seem like what they're doing right now. Typically, what's restrained executives from trying to run amok like this, like the reason Joe Biden didn't pack the court or take some really extraordinary measure to protect abortion, was because he knew that as soon as he set those precedents, that every president after him could follow them. Donald Trump is not concerned about this. And it kind of makes me ask why. Like, if you are expanding executive authority this much, why aren't you worried that Democrats will use it against you when they're in office? And the only good answer is because they won't be in office. So I think that's something to think about as well. This is not going to be a revolution. This is not going to be a coup in the style of the 1960s and 1970s. This is going to be a very, very slow trickle of offenses until we no longer really follow a constitution at all. And because of that, right, and this is a hard thing for listeners, there is no one thing to look for. I think it's actually already happened. It's like the path towards this competitive authoritarianism, it's what Levitsky and Ziblatt would call it, it seems to already be a path that we are walking down, have been walking down for a little bit now.
In a recent interview with a podcast, Deep Dive with Sean Fetick, I believe you mentioned that the public have become desensitized to Trump's frequent outbursts and controversial comments. What sort of dangers does this pose, and how do you suggest people respond?
It's the outrage machine and flooding the zone. It's all of those strategies that Trump and his team have. And it's hard not to be desensitized to it. And sometimes you have to kind of ignore it, which makes it really difficult. So I think Trump's comment about turning Gaza into the Riviera of the Middle East is a good example. Extremely incendiary. Crazy. I'm not sure how this could actually happen. Like, this is so outlandish. I think that that was not a serious policy proposal. And I think that getting stuck on how outlandish and outrageous it was keeps people from seeing what's really going on, which is that Trump and Bibi Netanyahu have agreed that they're going to do really whatever Israel feels like is in its best interest, and that a two-state solution is completely off the table. So we're in this tricky position where when Trump says things that violate norms and are outrageous and hateful, you know, we should pay attention and we shouldn't ignore them. We shouldn't, you know, dismiss them and say, oh, he doesn't really mean that. But also focusing on the presentation can kind of obscure what's going on underneath, the more dangerous policy moves that are actually happening. So I think at this point, we almost have to ignore the presentation and look at the policy change.
Well, just before we finish, I just wanted to give you the opportunity, if there's any books or new work or research you'd like to point our listeners' attention towards?
Yes. So besides my 2020 book on the Tea Party, which I feel is still relevant, which you can definitely find online from the University of Chicago Press, I have a new book out with Hans Knoll of The Party Decides called Cooperating Factions, a Network Analysis of Party Divisions in U.S. Presidential Nominations. It's with Cambridge University Press. And it's part of their Element series. The nice thing about the Element series is that these are shorter books. They are meant to be easier to get through, but on a very specific topic. And so what we do is we take the endorsements data from The Party Decides, we extend it through 2020, and we mine the data to understand the factions within the parties better. We actually do see the splintering of the Republican Party that we are now living in. We do see it happening, kind of starting in 2008, the party just falling apart. So it's an interesting book to read right now as we're trying to think about the future of the parties and especially the relationship between factions and that future. So I think that's a big thing I would point people towards right now.
Well, listeners can check out links to those in our show notes. Just remains for me to say, Professor Rachel Blue, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Dr. Rachel Blue is assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and the Carl Albert Congressional Research and Study Center at the University of Oklahoma. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Dr. Rachel Blue for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're at LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Luke Digweed. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US, and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people to find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or of the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.